Good afternoon, everybody. This is, unfortunately, our last episode of Radio Laureate News at Noon for this academic school year. Thank you guys so much for tuning in every week, every Wednesday at 12 o'clock. Today, we're going to try and... We actually have Jacob on again.
Hello.
It's been a couple months, I want to say, since he's on.
Yeah, probably somewhere around that.
Yeah, so we thought we'd have him on to sort of end the year on a good note with some extra discussion. And yeah, guys, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for listening in, guys. It's been a little while since I've been on the show. For anyone who doesn't know, I'm the news manager here at Radio Laureate, and I'm glad to be on here with Jeffrey and Rajani and talk about the news of the week.
Yeah,
we're glad to have you back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, and glad to be back.
So I guess we should probably start with the most immediate pressing news for anyone who'd be listening right now, which would be Doug Ford's not lockdown, but his shutdown, his province-wide shutdown.
Yeah. So unfortunately, in Ontario, we're experiencing a really bad spike in cases. We've had almost 6,000 cases over the past 2 days. And 22 additional deaths. And as we probably know, although we have vaccine rollout, the variants of concern are actually spiking right now, which is part of the reason why he decided to launch us into this kind of shutdown thing. But my thing about the shutdown is, why not just do it properly? Because I feel like we've just been going on and off on like these half-assed shutdown measures, and it's not actually doing anything for the long term.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty much on the same page with you there. I think, you know, what really stands out to me is the fact that, like, small business owners are struggling.
Yeah, and malls can stay open.
While Yorkdale parking lots are full.
And Square One is open.
I was looking at, exactly. I mean, I was looking at pictures and videos. I think it was on City TV. They had a video of Yorkdale.
It was
packed. And it literally looked like a normal day pre-pandemic, except everyone had masks on.
Exactly. Which is so...
And...
It's so crazy to me.
You know, if we're going to try to do another lockdown and have it actually make a difference, we need to go the route of New Zealand
just
and
shut
just
it
completely
down.
Shut down the country for like 14 days or whatever, however long we need to do it, but make it a real lockdown, not these like half measures that just like, you know, prolong the
inevitable.
Exactly.
And another thing that I've noticed has happened is that, or I've read that has happened, is that people, especially in food service and retail where they're paid like hourly wages, don't have paid sick days. So they're going into work when they feel sick and spreading COVID that way because there's no other alternative. Because like if you have a kid at home and a family to support, are you really going to like take a hit and miss 2 whole weeks of work? Because that's...
Yeah, that one comes back to workers' rights and pensions and wages and stuff. Because like, you know, a lot of these, like if people across Canada and especially across America had better access to, you know, healthcare and the ability to not have to worry about missing 2 weeks of work because you have a potentially deadly disease, you wouldn't have to be coming in.
And spreading,
you know, people, you know, even pre-pandemic, people shouldn't have had to come in when they're sick for fear of not, you know, infecting anyone. And during the pandemic, it's only more evident that that's the case.
The pandemic just really magnified the need for all of these social measures that we have, like workers' rights, like sick day, paid sick days, childcare leave, like all of this stuff.
Mental
health
days too.
And basic personal income. Because I mean, for sure, crib, although like this whole year has been really stressful, getting crib has really made it easier for me to focus on school. Because I don't have to be worrying about, oh my God, I didn't get enough hours today, or like taking on 2 jobs or that kind of thing to like pay my bills, you know?
Yeah.
And you're absolutely not the only one in that scenario. Far from it, in fact. Like there are so many Canadians who are, you know, relying on these sorts of services to not have to, you know, draw this insane work-life balance or work-school balance.
Because, I mean, pre-pandemic last year this time, I literally had 2 jobs because my first job was not giving me enough hours. And I was, like, running myself completely raw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I think this whole pandemic, especially in Ontario, especially in Canada, is sort of showing the polarization in our country between, no one ever is on the same page about anything anymore, it seems.
Yeah,
it's tough.
I don't know if it was the right decision or the wrong decision. Personally, like, I don't know. I feel like the last lockdown did seem to drop the cases, like, a lot. In, like, only a month, we went from, like, 3,000 to 1,000 cases.
Yeah, but they locked down more things back in that lockdown. Like, I don't think dine-in restaurants weren't allowed. I mean, they're not allowed now, but, like, non-essential shops, retail shops, were not allowed to open. So, yeah. Like, even if you went to the mall, you couldn't go buy clothes or shoes or whatever. It was literally just the food court.
Yeah. I also think people, especially, like, in Ontario, realize how far behind we are on our vaccinations.
We're actually so disappointing for vaccines.
Oh, it's so brutal.
Like,
yeah, it's the worst.
Yeah, it's just... And you can't really blame, like, bureaucracy and, like, government officials because we don't produce the vaccine in Canada. And, like, America, China, Russia,
they all make it.
Yeah, so they can do it how they want. Like, for example, my sister, she lives in L.A. right now.
Yeah.
And she just got a vaccine because essentially anyone can get a vaccine.
Yeah. Right now. My friend in New Jersey, he got his vaccine. I think he and his girlfriend both got their vaccines, and they're like 20, 21.
Yeah, my sister's like 24. Wow. So, yeah, I don't know. It's it's interesting times we live in.
Yeah.
I mean, just looking at the U.S. right now, you know, with the stats I'm looking at right now, as of yesterday, 30% of the population have received at least one dose. Canada's
like 1% of our population has received their first dose. Is it?
I think it's a bit higher than that, in truth. I think it's closer to like 10%. Let me actually double check. But yeah,
we're lagging.
We're still nowhere near where we should be.
And here, it's almost halfway through the year as well.
15% of us have received at least one dose, which is half of what the U.S. has.
And we have less. We have 10% of their population, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, less than 10, I think.
Wow.
So it's just, I don't know. There's a lot that's concerning, and I think it's going to be something that's looked at very closely in future. Like like students in school are going to be studying why Canada's vaccine efforts were so lacking in comparison to the other countries as an issue of comparative politics. Like it's going to become evident, particularly in the next election.
Oh,
like,
for sure.
I'm pretty sure there's going to be a snap 100%. Election. And I don't think Ford's chances are pretty good. And I would argue the same with Trudeau.
Yeah, definitely not.
Because I think at the beginning of the pandemic, I don't agree with Ford's, all of his policies, especially not his education and OSAP policies. But I thought he was doing quite well in the beginning of the pandemic.
But yeah, I mean, it was evident that he had the best interests of Ontarians in mind, and that he was really trying. At this point, I think myself and a lot of people are just kind
of... We're tired of it.
We're kind of sick of it.
We're over it. Because, like, the thing is, I feel as though many people would not actually mind going into a lockdown if they knew that some actual concrete results could happen from it. Because I definitely wouldn't mind. Like, it's not like I'd go anywhere anyway. So, like...
And, like, the only thing is, like, the amount of people who are, you know, on board with a more serious lockdown... are also balanced out by the people who have, you know, flipped to the other side completely, saying we need to open up everything. We're sick of the lockdowns,
and I think while
it's easy to dismiss those groups, they're quite vocal. I was going to call them, I'd say they're a minority, but they're a quite vocal minority.
I actually think that these half-assed lockdowns have empowered these people to like actually speak out and seem legitimate.
Absolutely,
because the thing is, if we actually did it properly, people would be like, no, but you can see that lockdowns are actually working. But what it is right now is that we're in a non-ideal situation, and we're not even getting the results from that situation. Yeah. So there's like no benefit for us being in this, like sacrificing this much of our mental health and like our time and our social life. And it's what?
And because, and because there's such a, because of these sort of half measure lockdowns, we find ourselves in the same group as these people, in that both, you know, people who want a stricter lockdown and don't want the half measures, and people who want no lockdown at all, share in the opinion that we are sick of these lockdowns in their current state. There's just a disagreement on the methodology. So in having that agreement, it both empowers one side and doesn't empower the other.
I mean, I think in a time like this, this is like probably the only situation that a country or community, whatever, needs a politician with Trump's audacity. Because we need someone to just be like, yes or no. Like the state. Yeah. If you go state by state, DeSantis in Florida, hard no. Gavin Newsom in California, hard yes. And honestly, like, they're obviously mixed results. But, you know, at least that way one is getting sacrificed and the other is getting saved, instead of both kind of like 50% floating.
Exactly. And you can point to the one who's being saved and say, see, this is a concrete result of this person's action, or like this action to choose to do this results in this. And it's like a clear example that people can see. And then if they decide to disagree with that, that's a matter of them like not agreeing with cold hard facts. But when it's like 50-50 like this, no one can even determine like what's the fact or not.
Yeah. And, you know, marginally, I would, you know, I would still personally prefer to do these half measures as opposed to completely up, because I can't imagine the carnage that that would involve. But I can understand the interest in having a politician who makes solid decisions that are, you know, future focused and that are concrete in their beliefs, so that, you know, we don't have to go through this sort of confusion.
Because most people, like the average person, is not, doesn't know what's going on. Like, we're all equally confused. So if at least someone acts as though that they're confident enough and like knows what's going on, then that would make us all feel a lot better.
Yeah,
it goes, you know, confidence goes a long way. And you know, speaking of confidence and you know, public trust, there's been this big issue. I'm not sure if you guys have been up on this, but in Waterloo, the Waterloo Regional Police Service has a new initiative that has been catching a lot of flack recently, called the Diversity Cruiser Project. Basically, what it involves is a lot of the police vehicles have been given decals with Black, Indigenous, and other racialized peoples onto these decals. Onto these police cars I guess it's supposed to be a sort of show of support and like, you know, kind of like, you know, like I guess in a similar vein to how, you know, someone would paint a mural of George Floyd in Los Angeles or something like that. But on top of that, there was also, and you know, I'm still learning about this. But there is, you know, the Waterloo Regional Police Service also was making trading cards, if I'm not aware. And these trading cards, let me just quickly look this up to make sure that I'm getting
this right. This whole thing seems very sus. Like, I don't like where this is going.
Yeah. So let me find this here. Apparently there were trading cards being handed out as part of the you know, as part of these efforts. And there's been a lot of backlash as a result. So I'm going to find out a bit more about that. But what are you guys thinking about that?
Personally, like, okay, my stance on policing is quite, I guess you'd say, nuanced. Because I've personally never had a bad experience with, like, Waterloo police. But I can't ignore, like, the systemic problems with police and how it kind of targets, like, people of color in general. So it's like, I don't think that we should, that police, like, are not needed. I mean, I think it's definitely needed to some extent, but I definitely agree, though, that we should focus more on, like, reducing the systemic problems that lead to crime as opposed to just increasing policing.
Yeah, like, I get their, I get where they're coming from. Like, they're trying to build, like, a connection to the community or whatever. But, I mean, my take is, A, like, a decal on a car is not going to change the opinion of someone who's lived a life time of discrimination
or surveillance. Yeah.
And B, like, I want to know how much those decals cost, where that money came from, And who thought, oh, with everything going on right now, let's put Indigenous artwork on the cars of people who, like, only investigate their murders? You know what I mean?
I just...
The thing is, it's not even Indigenous artwork to, like, represent, like, it's, like, here's what the news release said. In a news release, officials said the Cruiser is the first in the Diversity Design series, which aims to, quote, capture the spirit of Canadian newcomers as well as African, Caribbean, South Asian, and Arabic cultures. And the sergeant, Eric Boynton, said, our Equity, Inclusion, and Diversity Unit is always looking for new ways to highlight diversity in our community. This is another step in an effort to build positive bridges with our community partners. And in addition to these diversity cruisers, on CBC Morning Radio, they also mentioned that they're going to be coupling them with these trading cards for education and cultural, you know, that are supposed to help with education on cultural and racial heritage. And, you know, in my mind, something like, you know, the decals, it's nothing new. It's like how they painted, you know, it's like how the city, was it New York or Los Angeles? I'm not sure. One of the cities painted Black Lives Matter in big letters on their streets while all, and you know, nothing really changes. Yeah. It's a lot of performative politics.
I think the main problem is that we've kind of made diversity as like, I don't know if you'd call it commercialized, but it's kind of become commercialized because now it's just a marketing tactic to say, oh, we're a diverse company, or like, oh, we're a diverse organization.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you're going to put stickers of like people of color, the whole thing just seems like very poorly executed. Like some old person was just like, okay, what are the kids talking about these days? Diversity? Okay, yeah, like put all the colors of the rainbow on our police cars. Like, it's just so performative and hollow. And it's like, what does that actually do? I think a better initiative would have been for them to like interview maybe Indigenous elders and like get some insight into how law enforcement is kind of like how traditional ways of enforcing laws and norms happen, so that they can approach people who are of like racialized communities on their level instead of just resorting to the settler colonial violence of police brutality and surveillance. Like, that would have been a lot better of an initiative and like an actual show of solidarity and support, especially with Indigenous communities, that they could have done. Or even to talk to like, I guess because we have lots of immigrants in Waterloo, we could talk to people from those communities. Like if there's like Indian Association, South Asian Association, Asian Association, like talk to people in those communities and ask like, how does your cultural background define how you interact with things like the law or like police or law enforcement in general? Like, get insight into these people's backgrounds, get insight into, I mean, not these people, because I am these people. I mean, like, get insight into our backgrounds, like find out things that are actually that can help understanding instead of just trying to project an image of being all like PC and diverse and inclusive.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to like, you know, when projecting a good image becomes more important than actually doing good things, I think that's when it starts becoming an issue. And, you know, there's a bigchange.org petition that's getting a lot of signatures at the moment. They're trying to get to 5,000 right now. They're at 2,655, calling for the project to be canceled. And on top of that, for there to, for both the diversity cruisers and the trading cards to be canceled. And in addition, to provide a detailed itemized list of the total costs, including the costs of the planning, implementation, the paying the artist who designed it, and, you know, printing the trading cards and applying the decals to the vehicles, and then to donate all the money spent to Black and Indigenous-led community organizations. And, you know, it's one of those things that's like, you know, it's like when you see an ad of, you know, it sort of harkens back to me for that. Was it Kylie Jenner who did the Pepsi?
Oh, Kendall
ad?
Jenner. Yes. Here, have a Pepsi. Kendall stop Jenner, police brutality.
Where she stopped police brutality by offering everyone a Pepsi. Or, you know, I think a better example of this was, of like the sort of like, imaging towards a cause was what the NBA did. With a lot of their messaging after after George Floyd was murdered in May of last year, you know, with the whole redesign of their courts and all of the jersey changes and kneeling for the anthem and all that, I think it was a really good initiative on their behalf because it was very widespread across the league. It was very evident to the fans, and it was very obvious that they were all taking a stand against it. The sort of like half measures that were taking place in some of the other leagues like the MLB, and, you know, especially in conjunction with specific rules, you know, barring players from kneeling for the anthem and stuff, that was a bit more shaky. Yeah.
I think we're at this point in 2021, we're way past the point of performative gestures being considered as enough. Like, it's not like we don't have the information to actually make proper changes. We know how to do it. People know how to do it, and it's easily available if you just ask the right people. It's not like this such a big mystery. Exactly. People know what's going on. Like, social media has made it so that every single person, regardless of like education level or whatever, can access this information. So it's just, I don't know. I don't have anything in particular against Waterloo Police in general, but this just seems like very poorly executed.
And on top of that, for those who aren't aware of these issues, or for those who are like, you know, blissfully ignorant, that's no longer something that can just be attributed to, you know, to just like, you know, oh, I don't read the news. You have to be really, really trying to not hear about this, to not know about what's going on in the world today. Like, you have to really be out of the loop in a way that
it's like almost that has willful. It's like willful acceptance of ignorance at that point.
Exactly. And you know, that, you know, I can go on a whole tirade about people who are apolitical or don't have a political opinion, because, you know, usually they do and they're just afraid to say it. I'm going to go out and say that now. But, you know, that's another story.
Yeah. Speaking of police, let's talk about the Derek Chauvin trial, which is currently going on.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just going to preface by saying I'm glad you called it the Derek Chauvin trial, because a lot of people, you know, online and otherwise have been calling it the George Floyd trial.
But George Floyd is not on trial.
Exactly. George Floyd is not on trial. George Floyd was murdered. Derek Chauvin is on trial
for the murder of George Floyd.
So I'm glad we made that distinction early, because I think it's an important and a very prescient one as well.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, so probably the most interesting development from this trial is that this is, I don't think officially, but like one of the only times that a police chief has testified against an officer. So,
wow.
Yeah, Minneapolis Police Chief Arredondo, excuse my terrible Spanish. he's not yet testified. I think it's literally happening as we speak. There's like a live stream. There's a live stream on it. But yeah, he's supposed to basically testify that Chauvin used excessive use of force, and that everything they did not teach in police training. So essentially what I'm getting from public opinion is, if that is not enough to convict him of something, then there's going to be a lot going on in the states, a lot of public outcry, probably similar protests to last May or June or whatever it was.
Wow.
Like riots or whatever you want to call it.
Jesus.
I'm not surprised. Like, yeah, honestly, I would riot too if he doesn't get If he doesn't get convicted,
it's on video. People have testified that this is a habit for him.
Yeah.
And his own chief has testified against him. So what, like, okay, if people didn't know that white supremacy ran the courts in the US, after this, like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, if you don't agree that the court system and the legal system is run on white supremacy, if he gets acquitted after all of this, then, like, I'm sorry, you're probably living in a delusion.
You know, as a law student, I'm not going to say I feel bad, but I wouldn't want to be Derek Chauvin's lawyer moment. Because I can imagine he probably has the hardest job in the world at the moment, trying to argue in good faith as Derek Chauvin's defense lawyer that Chauvin was in a fight for his life
while
kneeling on a prone handcuffed corpse. Ridiculous. Of a man.
Well, backed up by three other officers who were with him. Yeah, like four on one, that's like fighting for your life. Clearly.
there's a video I saw from the trial of one of a bystander that was being interviewed, and God, the way he was being questioned just really annoyed me. It was like every single one of the, like, it was a 2-minute clip, and every single one of the questions was like, you called the officer this, you called the officer that, is that true? And like every single time, like, this guy kept his composure. Because it was just so obvious that the defense was trying to paint him as this, like, you know, angry black man who's just, like, you know, enraged about this killing, and obviously like, I'm being hyperbolic here, but obviously, like, you know, he's can't be a trustworthy witness because of that. But
because he had a rational human response to seeing someone die.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. And like every question that he was being asked, he kept his calm somehow, and was just able to, you know, they're asking him like, and you called this police officer, like, I'm paraphrasing here, I don't remember the wording, but like, you called this police officer like an effing pig, and he was like, is that true? And he was like, well, watch the video, like, you saw the video, like check the video. Like, it's just like a lot of this is just with all these heavily publicized trials. It's going to be interesting to look back, you know, it's, everything's happening around us, but looking back on this and being able to analyze it step by step, like we're now able to do with something like, for example, the OJ Simpson trial. I think that's going to be really interesting in future. And, you know, if, you know, God forbid, Chauvin is acquitted, this is probably going to be one of the biggest trial. I mean, there's going to be one of the biggest trials in US criminal history regardless, but if he gets acquitted, it's going to be one of the, if not the biggest criminal trial in U.S. history.
Yeah, I think, honestly, I think there's no way he gets acquitted just from an optic standpoint, and because Biden's in office too, you know, he's on the lines of the prosecutors, you know, like, you know, he's doing the most, because it just, that's just going to look terrible on him and the Democratic Party in general, because people were kind of like, oh, Trump's in office, this was allowed to happen. Oh, now, like, Biden's in office, this shouldn't be able to happen, which is obviously not how it works. But just seeing all the things that Biden's been doing to try and, like, push for social change, whatever.
Yeah.
I think that there'll be higher powers that might play a role in this. And the police chief is testifying
against his own officer.
That his officer used excessive force. Like, I think the worst case scenario is the man gets, like, 2 to 4 years, something like that, for like whatever, some manslaughter or whatever. Christ. You know, I don't know too much. I don't know too much about the U.S. criminal system, but like, I just feel like that's probably what's going to end up happening, just because that just seems to always happen in these sort of situations. But yeah.
I'm glad you actually brought up your perspective as a law student, Jacob, because I always wonder, like, in these cases where the person's obviously guilty, like, there's so much evidence, how do the lawyers cope with that? Like, how do their defense lawyers actually, like, formulate a case when it's so glaringly obvious that the person is guilty?
Well, I mean, with something like this, I mean, even the idea of, like, obviously guilty is something that needs to be taken into question when considering a legal issue. Like, all three of us here can very safely agree that we believe that Derek Chauvin is guilty of murder here. But when you start getting down into the specifics, you know, that's when you start getting, like, you know, questions. Because I know people who would say that Chauvin isn't guilty of murder, but he is guilty of manslaughter. I'm sure that if we looked at the specifics, we would all disagree on whether he's guilty of first, second, or third degree murder. And, you know, when it gets down to it, when you look at people on all levels of the spectrum, there will be people who will say that Chauvin is innocent, and there will be people that say Chauvin should be put to death. So, you know, there's all levels. And in knowing that, the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. You need to be sure that beyond a reasonable doubt, Chauvin murdered him. And if you're not sure beyond a reasonable doubt, you have to acquit. That's what happened with the OJ trial. There was a reasonable doubt that OJ was the killer. You know, in the eye of the public, pretty much everyone agrees that he did it. But in the eye of the jury that day, I'm pretty sure it was a jury trial, there was a reasonable doubt.
He was
acquitted. So you couldn't, and hence the phrase that was popularized in that trial, like, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. because that was the piece of evidence that really pushed the trial towards the acquittal that he eventually garnered.
Yeah. So I guess you're saying that it's more a matter of like proving the extent as opposed to, like in situations like this, it's proving the extent to which this was first degree, second degree, third degree murder or whatever, as opposed to proving whether he's like, guilty. I mean, like whether he actually killed him.
Well, I think there's a logical procession of things. Like there needs to be, ground rules established and sort of base facts determined that you can say, okay, this happened, that happened, this happened, that happened. So, you know, from the video, we can clearly tell that Derek Chauvin kneeled on George Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. That much is evident. No one is going to argue that that is not a fact. And then, you know, just now, like a doctor confirmed that George Floyd likely died of asphyxia. Of, you know, having his, you know, not being able to breathe in day six today of the murder trial. So now we've got people, you know, we've got him saying that, and we've got the medical examiner who did the family's ordered autopsy. But then, you know, from there, we've got one medical doctor saying that. But then, you know, the defense might have a doctor that says, oh, no, he had this in his blood or that in his blood, or it wasn't the asphyxia or whatever. So, you know. It's a very complicated process that can often get things wrong. I'm not going to say often, but that has gotten things wrong in the past and will get things wrong in the future. But I think, you know, the ultimate goal is to ensure that as few things are gotten wrong as possible in the legal system.
I think we're coming to about.
We're actually over time.
We're good. We're over time by a few minutes. Doesn't really matter. It's our last show. Yeah. We can spare a few minutes.
Cut us some slack, guys.
it's been a bit of a depressing show this week, but let's try to finish it off on a high note.
Yeah, I promise you guys, our first show next semester in September, we will be saying how there's no more COVID.
Fingers crossed.
One can hope.
We're going to be rejoicing.
We're going to be talking about how we finally hit 95% vaccine.
Yes.
you know, all that stuff, all that good
patience,
stuff.
Patience, everybody. Patience is virtue. Hope so. But Rajni, you want to do a little outro?
Yeah, for sure. So I'd just like to wrap up the show by thanking everyone for tuning in and watching us grow over this whole year. Because I know for sure I personally have learned a lot and grown so much from being on this show. And thanks to Jeffrey and Jacob for being like really good co-hosts.
Thank you, Rajni.
We'll see you guys in September.
Yeah, thank you guys. It's been an absolute pleasure working with you two and putting together what was at first News at 9 and what is eventually News at Noon, and what has become a really great show that I think is, you know, I'm glad to have had the chance to work with you two, and thank you all for listening to us throughout this journey.
Yes, guys, thank you so much. Just for a little wrap up from me, I've never 5 years ago never thought I'd have my own radio show. As much that's a little bit too much of a flex, but
not a flex at all.
But thank you, Rajni. Thank you, Jacob, so much for a great year. I had a lot of fun.
No,
next year is going to be a lot better of a show. We had a year of practice. Next year is the real runtime. And rest in peace, Yafit. Everybody, see ya.
See you guys next year.
Absolutely. Best of luck on exams,
have
everyone.
A good summer.
And let's finish this year off strong. Have a nice summer and see you in the fall.
Bye.
Peace.